The Lives of the Poets was the work that Johnson wrote when he was famous, because for much of his career he wasn't famous, and it's a work he wrote in his relative old age. He began it in his late 60s, and by the time he did so, he was the best known, the most revered man of letters in the nation. And that reputation was built not just on many decades of unacknowledged and often anonymous journalistic work, reviewing, biographies, but as far as most of the reading public were concerned, two great works. The first, which took him almost a decade, was his Dictionary of the English Language, which was published in 1755 and gained him the name Dictionary Johnson, which is one of the most extraordinary one-man projects in the history of literature. The first really systematic dictionary of English, in which all the words are illustrated by quotations from the best authors, all of it written by Johnson, all of the definitions written by Johnson, but also all of the examples supplied from his extraordinarily copious reading. That was the work that catapulted him from anonymity to fame. The second great work that he completed in his middle age was his edition of the works of Shakespeare, which he published in 1765. And it's very interesting, I think, that the three largest undertakings of his life, the dictionary, the edition of Shakespeare, and finally this, the Lives of the Poets, were all critical or editorial works, and they were all undertaken at the behest of publishers, of booksellers, as they were called in the 18th century. So although they were great literary undertakings, they were also commercial projects, and they were projects begun by other people who came to him and asked him to do them, rather than works of, if you like, original inspiration. The Lives of the Poets is now a work that we read as being by Johnson. But originally, it was intended, the Johnsonian part of it, just to be an attachment to a great multi-volume edition of the poetry of leading and less leading English writers. Because in the 1770s, a particular legal case had for the first time made it clear that no one could own the perpetual copyright in the work of a dead writer. And suddenly this meant that anybody could publish cheap editions of the classics and make money from it. And a group of London booksellers undertook to do this, to publish a huge multi-volume edition of English poetry, of the works of English poets. And they hired Johnson to write what they thought would be brief biographical prefaces to the work of each individual poet. But actually, Johnson took so long to do it because his lives of some of the writers who most interested him, of Milton, of Dryden, of Cowley, took him so long that actually the edition of the poetry appeared before Johnson had finished writing the prefaces. So actually, the prefaces appeared as they do for readers nowadays, separate from the volumes of poetry that they were supposed to adorn. And Johnson was hired because, as the most famous man of letters in the nation, it was thought that his name would give the project kudos, would give it gravity. Johnson was a great writer, a wonderful critic. He's also someone who I think was greatly responsible for forming English literature. English literature is a group of texts worthy of study and rereading. And English literature is something that was good enough to rival the great literature of Greece and Rome. And one way of seeing the Lives of the Poets is as the final step in that Johnsonian creation of English literature. His Dictionary of the English Language is, in a way, a great work of literary criticism, because all the words are illustrated from the greatest writers, and especially they're illustrated from Shakespeare. So Shakespeare becomes, in the dictionary, I think for the first time in English, acknowledged as the repository of all the most memorable sentiments and uses of words that one's likely to find. And this standing that Shakespeare is given is confirmed 10 years later in Jonson's edition of the works of Shakespeare. So the lives of the English poets actually contains the lives of very many figures who are now forgotten and unknown. But the writers to whom Jonson devotes most time and most space are the same poets whom he quotes most often in his dictionary: Dryden, Pope, Milton. And those become the three central figures. So the very fact that he's doing that, also the fact that the booksellers, the publishers, think that publishing a multi-volume edition of English poets is a money-making venture. These are both symptoms of this, I think, new creation of English literature, something that belongs on the shelves of any gentleman and perhaps many ladies too. I think that the modern reader who's used to reading literary biography will be surprised by how irreverent Jonson's lives are, especially the lives of the poets whom he revered the most, actually, because Jonson, whilst wanting to celebrate the achievements of writers like Milton and Dryden and Pope, is fascinated by all the ignoble and commercial aspects of the life of writing. So the lives of the poets is a repository of anecdotes in which we find the vanity and the prickliness and the oversensitivity of writers illustrated. Writers are not, in Jonson's depiction, glorious people. They're no better. In fact, sometimes you think they're a good deal worse than the rest of us. And in a way, although Jonson is writing literary lives of men that he, with one important exception, never knew, he's also writing about the life of authorship that he has himself known. You can see that most vividly in the life of the man, in the lives of the poets that he did know, Richard Savage. His Life of Savage had actually been published in an earlier form more than three decades earlier. And Savage was a poet of absurd self-regard, but rather magnificent obduracy, whom Jonson had himself known very well as a young man when he too was a needy hack. And it's an extraordinary portrait of the self-solacing vanity that perhaps all impecunious writers need to have. And that sense that Jonson's own experience of the indignities of authorship is there in all his lives, that goes through, I think, that autobiographical impetus is there in each one of the accounts in this collection. Jonson is a brilliant critic, a wonderful close reader, actually. And I think modern readers, especially perhaps students of English literature and academics who are used to the business of practical criticism or close reading of poetry, will recognise the skills that Jonson deploys as one's familiar in the work of other great critics like William Empson or Christopher Ricks. However, there are also peculiarities to Jonson's criticism, and oddly enough, it's in his critical comments rather than his biographical accounts that he sometimes seems most of his time. He has an idea which is very important in his formulation of the progress of English literature, that there is such a thing as improvement and progress in the writing of poetry. Like many men and women of his time, he believed in standards that we might now find rather odd of refinement and polish and correctness in the writing of poetry. And whilst the greatest writer in his view in English literature is Shakespeare, a man who died a century and a half or more before he began his Lives of the Poets. So anybody who reads his preface to his edition of Shakespeare will perhaps be surprised to find that even though Johnson reveres Shakespeare, he finds in him faults which are a consequence of the relative barbarism of his times. And equally, in the Lives of the Poets, some of the writers he most admired will be credited with improving English poetry rather as we might think a physicist or an engineer might improve knowledge of the material world. And I think we're not used to thinking of poetry in that way as something that somehow improves. But Johnson definitely did think that. And he thought that only perhaps in the 18th century had English become as good a language for poetry as Latin had been. And that's been due to the efforts of writers in the 17th century, some of whom, like Dryden, we still read and admire, but many of whom, like Denham or Waller, are now forgotten, but who Johnson thought had a very important place in the story of English literature. You will therefore also find that he has a peculiar preoccupation with writers' faults. Now, this is not something that critics, I think, do particularly anymore. If you're writing about Paradise Lost, you're very unlikely to have a section on Milton's faults, but this is what Johnson does. Just as in his preface to Shakespeare, he had a section on Shakespeare's faults as a writer, faults as a playwright. So this is, we might think, a consequence of the values of his times. But actually, there's also something often quite enlightening about it, because Johnson has a very empirical, commonsensical attitude to what poetry does. Poetry tells the truth eloquently, as far as Johnson's concerned. So he's very suspicious of poets who, in any kind of blur of fine words, are out to trick the reader into believing that something that sounds good is therefore true. And he analyses, for instance, rather brilliantly, Alexander Pope's An Essay on Man as a work which is wonderfully well written, but somehow meretricious when you actually analyse what it's saying. And I think many critics would think that without adopting Johnson's own codes of correctness and polish and veracity, there is still something probing and valuable about the way that Johnson refuses to let a writer as accomplished as Pope get away with saying things which sound neat but are actually either contradictory or untrue. The tricky thing in doing an edition of The Lives now for the contemporary reader is deciding how much of it to include. And I decided that the reader now is unlikely to be interested in the lives of Pitt or Pomfret or Yalden. So I have selected the lives of the poets who still most engage us. And those are also the ones to which Johnson gave most thought and most space. They're the longest lives. And I've given them in my edition in unexerted form. So you can read the very detailed critical analyses that Johnson undertakes of passages from lyrics by Donne or from bits of Paradise Lost. But I have also tried to give, at least in my introduction, tried to give a reader a sense of what I've had to leave out, what Johnson has said about writers who are not in my volume, and about the range and the kinds of writers that he's included. And we should remember that in most cases, Johnson didn't choose those. Those were chosen for him by the booksellers. So I hope that any reader who is interested enough, patient enough to read the introduction, we'll get some sense of what the larger work is like from which this selection has been taken.